Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Yeah, so I think the big question really is, so in the UK, I think there's and we kind of touched on it about the paramedic versus doctor versus operator experience kind of discussion. But in the UK, I think, certainly anecdotally, and in fact, I think it's in the literature as well, there's a the kind of concept of paramedic RSI is something that is people kind of have issue with. It's a regular discussion, and there's no places that deliver paramedic RSI, so it's all doctor led, and the conversation seems to be about that rather than about the operator experience. So I think when the topic of paramedic led RSI is brought up, there's pushback from a lot of people in the medical community, and a lot of that argument is about how paramedics generally don't get the experience the doctors do from their clinical rotations and their kind of different areas of specialty. And a lot of the literature that is cited in that discussion is, like, as we discussed, is the non-specialist paramedic literature, the PART trial. There was the Airways 2 trial in the UK, which had a relatively low success rate as well. So when it was introduced as an intervention for you, what was the kind of feeling for the medical community? How was that received?
Yeah, look, it's definitely has been a controversial procedure in the past. It's not now. It's well accepted and well established, and that's due to the strength of our systems and the training we underwent and the advocacy of Dr. Bernard and others. And us being able to demonstrate to the medical community that we could do it appropriately. So there was absolutely controversy at the time. We heard we'd be killing patients and, you know, that sort of thing. And I think that has more to do with tribalism than actual patient care. We were incredibly fortunate that not only Steve Bernard, but a lot of our colleagues in the anaesthetic world supported us and continue to support us. So part of our training includes anaesthetics rotation, both adult and pediatric, although we don't on road RSI pediatrics, anyone under the age of 12 at this stage. So our HEMS paramedics do. That reflects obviously a different caseload and a different environment that they have to work in. But part of their deal with that is that they must reaccredit every 12 months at the local or at the tertiary children's hospital in Victoria.
So that's kind of interesting in itself, sorry to interrupt. This is interesting in itself, the HEMS primary thing, isn't it? Because as we've discussed, that is sort of in itself evidence that it's not about the profession as much as it is about, as you say, the area of operation and operator experience. And that seems a kind of appropriate strategy, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. So the pediatric RSI, I've been to in 16-odd years as an intensive care paramedic, I think two patients who I really wanted to RSI. Both of them were brain injured patients. Neither of them trauma. One of them was a post-hanging, and one actually just recently, with what we didn't actually know was going on, turned out to be some weird syndrome, but nonetheless presented as a primary brain injury in an eight-year-old. And although there's an absolute desire when you go to those patients to treat them in a certain fashion, including RSI, I'm okay with not RSI pediatrics, because they represent such a tiny, tiny part of our workload. We see a lot of adults who need intubation or airway management, more to the point. We just don't see children. So, you know, the only reason our HEMS paramedics continue to do so is there is a greater need, not necessarily because of their caseload. They're not necessarily seeing a lot of pediatric patients. But when they do, they obviously have a very different environment in which to transport them, where safety is paramount. And the only way they continue to do that is because they are required to spend time every year in pediatric theatre going over airway management reaccrediting. So for reference, though, we have about, I think, around 40 HEMS paramedics in Victoria, maybe a little more, and we currently have just under 500 MICA paramedics in total. So to be able to provide that level of ongoing accreditation for a very small group of 40-odd people is feasible. It becomes very much not feasible anymore when we're looking at close to 500.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And it's kind of reflective, I suppose, of the picture we see in the UK. So I kind of feel, as I say, in my job, we go to a lot of cardiac arrests. And so I'm often in a position with a post-ROSC medical cardiac arrest patient where you think RSI probably has a place in this patient. And that's often comes from a position, I think, of comfort, knowing that clinically we're quite comfortable with the physiology and the pathophysiology and the management of that medical case, but also largely from the fact that this is an airway we've been looking after for the last 30 minutes, say. So we have a bit of an understanding of that individual's airway complications or potential complications and how easy or not that airway is to manage. Whereas we less commonly go to trauma cases because that's more often an air ambulance kind of case. And so when I do go to the head injury patient, it never crosses my mind that I'd like to RSI that person, because clinically I'm much more out of my comfort zone. And I think the risk benefit kind of situation is different, because that's, you know, it's different to have a self-ventilating head injury versus a poorly ventilating post-ROS patient that you're kind of more comfortable with. So I think it's similar in the UK, but the patients are different.
Yeah, well, the thresholds probably are different, but I think that represents a very mature approach to it. Too much of the discourse from paramedics, unfortunately, is driven by ego. And certainly when you look at some of the US, if not all of it, I have friends and colleagues in the US who are brilliant paramedics who run rings around me, and their services are brilliant as well. But obviously it's a very mixed bag. And you look at some of the discourse around pre-hospital intubation, let alone RSI, and it makes me feel a bit ill. The attitudes and the egos and the lack of insight. One of the advantages, of course, with that post-arrest patient you're talking about is, by and large, we know that our fallback plan already works. So the worst-case scenario, sort of, we go to intubate a patient and for whatever reason we are unable to, we already know that the LMA has been working, the IGL has been working. So there's a lot less stress, I suppose, in where do we go with a failed intubation, because failed intubations happen. It's not a reflection of an individual or a system. It happens. But knowing you've got a fallback that already works is a great comfort.
Yeah. And I think for me, I mean, I don't have the experience or really the expertise to comment too much, but I think that is my kind of logical stance on the situation is, as you say, there's so many layers of fallback in that specific context. As you say, that firstly, the patients, you've been looking after the airway for a while, so you know, especially if you reach the ROSC phase, that you're definitely able to ventilate that patient and oxygenate them. And so if the intubation does fail, then you have the fallback of the supraglottic airway. And there's plenty of evidence to say that a paralyzed patient can be ventilated well and safely with supraglottic airways. And so I think
that's modern surgery, isn't it? That's most patients.
Well, exactly. And that's the thing. And we also have, because of the sedation drugs we carry and the cases we go to, we also have front of the neck access. So you then have that layer as well. And again, the data shows that generally pre-hospitally, front of neck access is a quite successful intervention. And so there's so many layers of safety that for me, the kind of risk benefit seems appropriate in that regard. But that kind of leads me to one of the final questions, I guess, which is, how do you deliver that intervention safely? Because in the UK, we work in a model where we work on cars and by ourselves, and then we go to support a crew, and generally there'll be only one critical care paramedic with a mixture of ambulance grades, and unless it's only special circumstances, pediatric arrest or significant trauma, where you'd expect to see more than one critical care person. And so how does that work for you in delivering that intervention? Do you have multiple ICPs? Do you have a set requirement for who's needed?
So there is a definite or a very clear organisational preference that two intensive care paramedics are involved with any RSI. And there is caveat within our guidelines saying that if you are unsupported, if you're there on your own, you do not oblige to carry out RSI. And I'm fortunate, I work in a metropolitan area, that is usually the case. However, my colleagues who work in rural areas, that is almost never the case. So we rely on a very robust training system. We rely on very clear and robust guidelines. We do have checklists. I am a bit checklist agnostic, but I think there are definitely circumstances where they are worth their weight in gold. So in my setting, generally, I work in a relatively small urban area with intensive care paramedics that I most likely have worked with for a long time. We have all trained the same. We all share a mental model. We talk about our cases. Checklists in that environment are of less benefit than if we're looking at a scratch team who don't know each other, who have varied clinical levels, clinical experience, clinical knowledge. And that's the environment where a checklist is absolutely required. So that is...
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Generally how we go about it, definitely two paramedics, intensive care paramedics, if we can. And if not, we can still intubate patients, but we are supported not to. And that just recognises the cognitive load, the bandwidth required. There's a difference between the uncomplicated and the complicated, you know, your threshold for when you might progress with intubation and when you won't will obviously change with your patient. There are cases we've reviewed where intubation was required and didn't occur. We tend to be more stringent about errors of commission, though, than we are errors of omission. And it's something that I'm also sort of struggling with a little bit in reviewing cases, which is part of my role. Is we are quick to review and remediate where errors are perceived to have come from actions. We tend to let slide incidents where the errors are of omission, where people say, oh no, I just decided to load and go. And loading and going doesn't work if your patient isn't ventilating or oxygenating. So I don't think it's defensible. So it's just a cultural thing and something we need to, or we are addressing.
Yeah. I think that's an interesting, and it generates a discussion in itself, I suppose, doesn't it? But I think that's an interesting point, like you say, is if you're the, and it's, I think it's the same in most services, but if you're, collectively, if we're looking at errors of commission, as you say, it kind of suggests that the intervention is still under scrutiny. Whereas if you objectively think this intervention is appropriate, we've proved that with the data and the literature and whatever, and this is now an objectively safe intervention that we do as a service, then, as you say, we should be looking at, yes, problems where it was used inappropriately, but also those patients who were who weren't delivered that intervention and actually might have benefited from it, they should have, as you say, a similar level of scrutiny, because if objectively you think the intervention is safe, then...
Yeah, we've moved past why did you do this, and we're now at a point where we're comfortable enough with the procedure and the safety of it and the ability of our paramedics to carry it out, that we're now at the point of not asking why did you do it, but selecting those cases, seeing those cases and saying, well, actually, why didn't you RSI someone in this setting? It's no different to why didn't you cardiovert this patient, or, you know, we're at that level of comfort with it. There are still challenges, though. One of the challenges we have is actually the number of intensive care paramedics and the number of intubations they're carrying out and how we ensure that. So we intubate, or we RSI, around 1,200 times a year in Victoria, spread across our...
How does that work out per individual?
Well, that's the issue, is that that is fairly concentrated into a relatively small percentage of those intensive care paramedics. So Victoria is a state that covers 276,000 odd square kilometres. It's a big place. And we have intensive care paramedics right across it. So for me, in a relatively low socioeconomic, busy urban setting, I intubate an RSI a lot. I'd be very surprised if I went a week without intubating at least one person, if not more. For colleagues who work in rural or remote areas, that becomes problematic if they're only seeing one or two patients a year who might need intubation, let alone RSI. So one of the things we're thinking about at the moment, our medical director, David Anderson, and various people involved in sort of the quality assurance side of things, we're trying to think about how we manage that risk. It's not about individuals. It's not about, you know, Joe Bloggs doesn't intubate anyone, so he's terrible. It's about how do we manage the risk of people who are not doing a high-risk procedure often enough to feel comfortable with it, or worse, are comfortable with it but aren't proficient with it. And so that's our, sort of one of our ongoing challenges.
Yeah, I think so. So what we found with our service evaluation is our specialist parents are intubating about 30 people a year on average, which is similar to other services. But then it for me, it's interesting to kind of reflect on that number, because without the ability to provide post-ROSC airway management, or in fact, without the ability to intubate anyone that's not in cardiac arrest, essentially, obviously those numbers are going to be smaller than if there was that ability. And so we have the Association of Anaesthetists in the UK basically recommends that an intubator, and actually their language is quite progressive, I think, as well. They don't refer to specialties. They just say, I don't know what their terminology is, but they refer to an operator. And they basically say that the operator has to have, I think from the top of my head, it's about 60 intubations a year, with a mixture of real life cases and simulation, although I think the predominant experience in real life cases. And you kind of think, I think probably in our service, given that we're intubating 30 cardiac arrests a year, probably if we did have the ability to provide drug assisted or RSI intubation outside of that context, the numbers would probably increase and actually would probably meet that. But then again, we don't have the same split in terms of rural and urban services. Certainly where I work, it's generally the same mix of semi-urban, which in the UK is very different to what your definition would be, I'm sure.
Yeah. You know, with those sorts of numbers, I think you'd certainly get there. So the 60 number comes from a paper from a bit of literature whose author and title completely escapes me at the moment. The actual number 64 a year to be proficient. Quite how that works, I'm not entirely sure. But certainly with a mix of real world and simulation, I think you'd absolutely be able to get there. So if I were to design an RSI program, and the thing that any service needs to think about if they do want to go ahead with this is it's hard work. It takes a lot of time, it takes a lot of energy, it takes a lot of money. Because it has to be done properly or not at all. So there has to be buy-in from the entire organisation, from the specialist paramedics through to upper management and through the sort of medical fraternity in the area as well. But the cardiac arrest would certainly be the sort of starting point if I were to design a system from what you described to say, well, we see X number of cardiac arrests. We know we have the fallbacks. We have front of neck access. We have working LMAs. We also have time. So, you know, not that we want to dawdle on scene with post-arrest patient, but optimizing physiology is important, and it is not the same as having a bleeding trauma patient for whom we can't optimize physiology, where transport is of greater importance. A bit of time spent optimizing physiology, ventilation, oxygenation, perfusion is time well spent with a post-arrest patient. So that would be the in is start, you know, in for selected specialist paramedics in these circumstances, you can go ahead and RSI the post-arrest patient. That would then allow you to demonstrate competency, safety, review it, and as we did in Victoria post our trial, expand the indications and expand who we can intubate, who we can RSI, because we can demonstrate we can do it safely in this cohort, and we'll keep spreading it to other cohorts as is appropriate.
See what happens with that. I think the other thing that kind of springs to mind is, as I said, so we have ALS paramedics, or the version of, but we also have a model in the UK where we have multiple different grades. And so we have support workers who are kind of assistant role and don't have any sort of clinical autonomy to work by themselves. But then we have a middle area where we have associate ambulance practitioners or ambulance technicians who are a lower grade than paramedics. So can't provide ALS interventions like vascular access and drugs or intubation. But they are considered clinically autonomous in that they can be the lead clinician on an ambulance. And so quite often we work with crews who are non-paramedic crews. So, and I mentioned before, you might go to a cardiac arrest and you're the two crews that are there don't have paramedics. And so there's more responsibility on the specialist paramedic to provide paramedic intervention as well. So, you know, vascular access, cardiac arrest drugs and all of that kind of stuff. And so I think that would be an added layer of complication if you're going to try and provide a RSI intervention. But then I wonder, that kind of leads me on to the question of experience. So we've discussed the experience of ICPs, but what is the experience of paramedics in terms of assisting with that? Because I think in my experience, often ambulance crews are very good at assisting with intubation, but sometimes you work with a crew who's newly qualified or hasn't been to a cardiac arrest for over a year, and they don't have the bandwidth or the kind of knowledge or experience to assist you with that intubation attempt. And so it's a much more lonely place. What's the kind of mixture for you?
Yeah, absolutely. So I mean, I guess in some ways we're fortunate that we don't have that degree of gradient. We're pretty fortunate that we have our ALS paramedics and we have our intensive care paramedics, and we don't sort of have further gradient. With that said, we have a very a young workforce now. I'm categorically a dinosaur now. We've had a lot of recruitment over COVID. So we have a lot of workforce who have never seen a cardiac arrest, let alone an RSI. And the ones who have, maybe they see a couple a year. So their ability to assist really depends still, although they're all at the same level, still does depend on their experience as well. It's an area that we have tried to address in changing the way we deliver RSI. So previously what we tended to do was one micro paramedic would run the job essentially. We'd do things like gain the access and draw the drugs up, and the other person, the other micro paramedic, was just the airway person. He intubated, and one of our ALS colleagues assisted us in the intubation. But of course they don't have the experience in airway management that intensive care paramedics do. So part of our approach to managing that risk and managing those issues of bandwidth and assistance is we now mandate that, or mandate's probably too strong a word, we strongly suggest that the two micro paramedics are on the airway. So your assistant, should things go wrong on the airway, is an experienced micro paramedic, micro intern potentially, and the drugs are given by an advanced life support paramedic under your direction. So little things like that help change things. It's also one of the areas, you know, where I say an organisation has to be committed. It would have to also be committed to providing that kind of resourcing to a case, which in this day and age, I know the pressures the NHS are under, and we are sharing those issues, although perhaps not to the same degree yet. we're all under a lot of pressure, workload, availability, and all that sort of stuff. So being able to do that in this day and age is obviously potentially really difficult.
Yeah, yeah, that is a fair point. I think, and certainly I think that's the way the air ambulance charities in the UK have worked very well in that regard. I mean, obviously they're largely outside of the politics of the NHS being a charity model, but I think in terms of their clinical response, it's obviously it's a two-person team, which takes away all of that reliance upon the team that you end up working with. And so they can really control they can control those factors very well, and you know, often, you know, if there's a good team, there's an experienced team, and they'll empower that team to assist with interventions and run the cardiac arrest, for instance. But if the team is inexperienced or doesn't have the knowledge to assist, then having a two-person well-versed team just means they can provide that intervention in any circumstance. So I think that's certainly a kind of cornerstone of their success as a model.
Yeah, I think it reflects all the things we've talked about, as it's about strong systems and support and all those sorts of things. And if that's the way it's provided, then it's not necessarily a bad thing. I definitely advocate for pre-hospital RSI regardless of who is providing it, so long as it's done well. The patient doesn't care. The patient wants to know that the procedure is done professionally and safely and so forth, in as much as that they're probably not in a position to know what's going on at all. But, you know, I don't think they would care at the end of the day if they walked out of hospital neurologically intact that it was a paramedic or a nurse or a doctor or a whoever. They'd just be grateful that it was done well.
Yeah, which I think is a perfect point to end on, really, is the patient experience, isn't it? And I think that kind of underlines the whole conversation, as you say, is that ultimately it's not, I think certainly for the patient, it's about the success of the intervention and the journey of care more than it is the operator that provides each individual intervention. As I say, I think that underlines things quite nicely. Is there anything you think we haven't discussed? I've certainly got most of my questions off my chest, I think.
No, I think that's it's been really good. Covered certainly all the issues that I lie awake worrying about at night, and it's good to talk about them. It genuinely is. You know, we're very proud of our system, but we also need to be realistic and talk about the challenges and you know where we need to improve, because this is no one system perfect. So I think we've covered a good bit of ground, and hopefully it's food for thought for your listeners. Certainly food for thought for me. Just thinking, you know, I've been doing this job and this service for a long time, and thinking about it from another perspective is great.
Yeah, no, it's certainly interesting to reflect, because as you say, having looked at some airway stuff in the past and seeing the similarities in terms, I actually find it surprising the similarities in terms of education and practice. In our services, and then that kind of stark difference in terms of the RSI, it's certainly interesting to reflect on and get those kind of differing opinions, I guess. Absolutely. Thanks for joining me. It's been really good to chat, and I appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you. Thanks very much. It's been a pleasure. Appreciate coming on, and stay safe, and I hope things ease up a little over there, and don't keep going the way they have. Looks like it has been.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.